Good morning, early birds. You've caught the worm, a podcast from Yellowstone Public Radio, rounding up reporting from our newsroom and Montana Public Radio. Today we have stories about the proposal to improve Wi-Fi in Yellowstone National Park, electric bikes, and what America's net farm income means for farmers. It's Friday, December 13th. I'm your host, Jess Sheldahl. The former president of the Northern Cheyenne Tribe was sentenced to 6 months in federal prison yesterday for fraud, Olivia Reingold reports.
Lawrence J. Kilsback was sentenced Thursday for a reimbursement scheme that resulted in the state, tribal governments, and federal agencies paying him thousands of dollars for fraudulent travel expenses. Prosecutors say that during his tenure as president and previously as the tribe's health director, Kilsback double-dipped and sometimes triple-dipped his travel expenses, filing them across multiple agencies, including the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. In July, he pleaded guilty to wire fraud and false claims conspiracy. Now he'll serve 6 months in federal prison, 3 months of supervised release, and have to pay more than $25,000 in restitution. Kilsback told investigators that travel fraud happens all the time on the reservation, where he says there's a culture of fraud. He said he knew of the scheme. He's not in custody and is allowed to self-surrender to a facility that is yet to be determined. For Yellowstone Public Radio News, I'm Olivia Reingold.
Olivia Reingold is Yellowstone Public Radio's Report for America core member. The Montana Department of Commerce announced this week that for the first time, state dollars are available to develop affordable rental homes for low to moderate income residents. Rachel Kramer reports.
The state's new multifamily Coal Trust Homes program is accepting applications on a rolling basis for low-interest loans from its $15 million pool of funding. A spokesperson for the Department of Commerce says the funding is expected to support 6 developments with about 40 units in each. The program is a result of House Bill 16 that was passed during the 2019 legislative session. It's considered the first time that state funds have been made available to support the construction or rehabilitation of affordable rental homes in Montana. The funding can also be used to buy land for multifamily rentals and land trusts for rental and mobile or manufactured homes. Loan repayments will be used to fund the development of additional homes. Applications from nonprofits, for-profits, and local government submitted by December 30th will be reviewed by the Montana Board of Housing at their next meeting, February 10th. With Yellowstone Public Radio News, I'm Rachel Kramer.
A fake bomb threat at the Kalispell Walmart Wednesday was initially labeled by law enforcement as a swatting incident, where pranksters hijack phone numbers in order to call in fake threats to police. But as Montana Public Radio's Aaron Bolton reports, the bomb threat was actually part of a scam to extort money out of a Montana correctional officer.
Kalispell Police Chief Doug Overman says the bomb threat called into the Kalispell Walmart Wednesday afternoon initially seemed like a swatting incident because the phone number that called the store had been hijacked to mask its true source. But after talking to the Montana correctional officer that number belongs to, police found out scammers had called the unnamed victim earlier that day asking for money. Overman says the scammers told the correctional officer they were going to use their phone number for nefarious acts if they didn't pay up and eventually called in the bomb threat. Overman says this is the first time he's seen this kind of scam.
I'm just at the cusp of trying to understand some of the threats of this, and hopefully our investigation leads us to understand again how we can prevent these kind of things in the future.
Kalispell police did respond to the threat and encouraged residents to stay away from the area. Overman says they were quickly able to determine there was no threat. Overman says his department is still investigating and hopes to discover who the scammers are. Aaron Bolton, Montana Public Radio News.
The Federal Bureau of Land Management issued new guidance yesterday for reducing wildfire risks along power line rights-of-way on some public lands. The agency's new policy authorizes utilities to do routine maintenance, like pruning and clearing dead fuels and hazard trees, to prevent or suppress wildfire without prior approval from the BLM. The policy also offers guidance on information the BLM should collect about utilities' work to prevent fires, like the size and type of trees utilities cut practices used and acreages. This fall, an electric utility in California shut off power to reduce the likelihood of its transmission lines igniting fires. Pacific Gas and Electric Company's transmission lines previously set the deadly Camp Fire ablaze in 2018. The U.S. Senate will consider expanding access to health care for Native American veterans and streamline the hiring process for tribal law enforcement. That's after two bills passed out of the Senate Committee on Indian Affairs Wednesday. Olivia Reingold reports.
We'll call the business meeting to order. Today, the committee will examine two bills.
The first, the Badges Act, would allow the Bureau of Indian Affairs to conduct background checks for its own law enforcement applicants. Right now, potential officers have to be screened through the U.S. Office of Personnel Management, which can take up to a year and a half to clear candidates. The Crow Nation has been outspoken in saying that lengthy background checks are part of the reason the tribe's police force is understaffed.
There being none, all in favor of the bill signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. The opinion of the chair is 1853 as amended passes.
Next, the committee, which includes Montana Senators Democrat John Tester, who co-sponsored both bills, and Republican Steve Daines, moved to the Health Care Access for Urban Native Veterans Act. It would allow urban Indian health clinics to be reimbursed for care by the Department of Veterans Affairs. Deshane Barnett is the executive director of the Urban Indian Health Center in Missoula.
Really what it's about is us being able to provide care without passing the cost on to the individual veteran.
He says the bill would help his budget go further and give veterans the care they deserve and sometimes expect. Once or twice a month, he says Native veterans walk in and say,
I'm Native, I'm a veteran, there's funding for Indian Health Service, there's funding for the VA, why are these costs not being covered?
The VA currently helps pay for services at Indian Health Service units, but not at any urban Indian health clinics, including the five in Montana. Both bills now move to the Senate floor, where they await votes. For Yellowstone Public Radio News, I'm Olivia Reingold.
Olivia Reingold is Yellowstone Public Radio's Report for America Corps member. Montana's largest utility says it needs to generate more electricity to meet customer demands, even after announcing plans to increase its stake in the Colstrip coal-fired power plant. Kayla DeRoche reports.
Northwestern Energy on Thursday announced it plans to issue a request for proposals, or RFPs, in January for 280 megawatts from on-demand sources like hydropower or natural gas to begin delivering electricity to customers in 2023. A draft of the company's long-term energy supply plan says that Northwestern will need an additional 725 megawatts by 2025 to meet times of peak customer demand. The plan models natural gas as the most efficient and cheapest option to meet that gap. Lou Lefebvre, director of long-term resources at Northwestern, says the plan serves as a guideline for the company and potential bidders.
But it's the RFP that will actually determine what type of resource, regardless of whether it's fossil fuel or renewable or some type of storage technology. It's the RFP that will determine that least cost path.
The company may seek additional RFPs in the future to fulfill its system needs. It says it currently only meets about 60% of its peak customer demand and often relies on purchasing electricity from the open market to meet the remaining need. Its long-term supply plan is currently before the Public Service Commission for feedback and has received widespread backlash from environmental groups for its failure to push for a renewable energy future. This week, Northwestern announced it plans to buy an added 25% share of Colstrip Power Plant Unit 4, a sale that will require the okay from state regulators. While other owners of the Colstrip Power Plant have said they plan to pull out as early as 2025, Northwestern has indicated it foresees maintaining stake in the plant into the 2040s. Kayla DeRoche, Yellowstone Public Radio News.
Yellowstone National Park officials are reviewing thousands of public comments on a proposal to improve Wi-Fi access in developed areas. Some people who work in the park say it's important for visitors and employee retention. Others worry it will only distract people from nature and lead to more commercialization in national parks. Rachel Kramer reports.
Zanterra, the company that runs a handful of hotels, restaurants, and campgrounds in Yellowstone, reached out to a wireless network company earlier this year to propose boosting internet speeds and connectivity in some developed areas of the park. Access Park's proposal to the National Park Service calls for installing equipment to increase internet access in certain buildings managed by Xanterra, some of which are historic. It doesn't call for any new towers or getting internet service into backcountry areas. Yellowstone spokesperson Morgan Worthen says the park is required by law to evaluate every proposal and have a public comment period. She and other park staff are in the process of reviewing nearly 3,000 comments submitted last month, which she describes as a healthy number.
We do have Wi-Fi in some of the developed areas. The issue is that, as most visitors who come to the park realize, that it's just very slow, it's limited.
But some people worry this is part of a slippery slope to privatize and commercialize national parks. The Interior Department's Made in America Outdoor Recreation Advisory Committee released a report in October with recommendations that include expanding Wi-Fi services, privatizing campgrounds, allowing food trucks, even Amazon deliveries at campsites, and restricting the use of senior discounts. The suggestions received strong pushback from conservation groups and AARP, as well as Montana Governor Steve Bullock. Jeff Rook, Pacific Director for Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility, or PEER, says he thinks the Park Service was influenced by the report. PEER has been outspoken in its opposition to the recent Wi-Fi proposal in Yellowstone.
Yellowstone appears to have taken on an assumed obligation that the park is responsible not just for protecting scenery and natural soundscapes and the sense of serenity, but providing strong signals to visitors.
Yellowstone spokesperson Morgan Worthen says the park hasn't made a decision on the proposal. She says Wi-Fi is important for public safety and finding and keeping employees.
We hear from employees, especially those who live in the interior, that it's really difficult, given the lack of internet, to stay in touch with their family, pay bills, and the like.
When Yellowstone announced Access Park's Wi-Fi proposal on social media last month, the majority of commenters said visitors would end up glued to their devices rather than out enjoying nature. Only 16 out of 140 comments on the park's Twitter post were in support of the proposal. Another 8 said employees and staff should have better Wi-Fi, but not visitors. That doesn't match up with Rick Honinghausen's experience. As Xanterra's director of sales and marketing, he says hotel guests submit complaints about spotty, slow internet on a daily basis, especially in the busy summer months when too many people try to connect and bog down the system.
Certainly a lot of people want to come here for the specific reason of disconnecting. We certainly understand that, and nothing about this changes that. If they don't want to be available, they can not have a phone, not turn on a phone, not bring a device that, you know, needs internet or cell service. The choice is still there regardless what happens going forward.
Yellowstone allows Wi-Fi anywhere cellular service is allowed, with the exception of the Old Faithful Inn and Lake Hotel. But Jeff Rook with PEER says Yellowstone's original wireless plan from 2009 didn't allow Wi-Fi in any historic buildings.
We found out that in 2018, without telling the public, we had to get this under the Freedom of Information Act, Yellowstone amended their plan to basically go back on what they promised in 2009.
Yellowstone spokesperson Morgan Worthen says staff did not open a public comment period in 2018 because it wasn't required by law and because the park says adding Wi-Fi would only minimally affect visitor experience. Worthen says she isn't sure when a decision on Access Park's Wi-Fi proposal will be made. With Yellowstone Public Radio News, I'm Rachel Kramer.
A federal order that lumps electric bicycles in with traditional bikes has sparked concern among environmental advocacy groups who say that e-bikes could hurt trail traffic and ecology in the Pryor Mountains. Kayla Jaroche reports.
It's a winter day in Billings with snow still on the ground, and the owner of a local bike store and I get on a couple of e-bikes in front of his shop.
So there's no power at all. You're just riding a heavy mountain bike right now.
Okay.
So let's pedal away.
Plus and minus buttons on one handle control the motor. I press the plus sign and get a somewhat unexpected boost of power behind my next pedal.
Whoa!
This mechanism is called pedal assist. As spokeshop owner Dean Cromwell explains, it makes you 4 times stronger than you would be otherwise.
Basically, there is a sensor built into the electric motor that senses how much you input. So it essentially makes you and I into a pro rider.
These e-bikes may soon be regulated under an updated travel management plan for southeastern Montana's Pryor Mountains. Earlier this year, U.S. Interior Secretary David Bernhardt signed an order that groups e-bikes that provide pedal assist up to 28 miles per hour together with conventional bikes. The order has drawn so much local pushback that the Bureau of Land Management Montana Dakota State Office spokesperson Al Nash says the agency last week extended the public comment period on the environmental assessment for the Pryor Mountains Travel Management Plan. He says it's up to the individual field offices how they implement the secretarial order.
It's extremely clear that any place where motorized vehicles would be allowed, that you would be able to take your e-bike. We don't have a mechanism in place yet regarding e-bikes on areas where you might otherwise take bicycles, but not clearly defined motorized vehicles.
Environmental advocacy groups are concerned about what impact e-bikes could have in the Pryors. The Montana Wildlife Federation and Montana Wilderness Association contributed to the large response, which Nash called unexpected. Eastern Montana Field Director at Montana Wilderness Association, Aubrey Bertram, says there needs to be more site-specific scientific study into the environmental and wildlife effects of e-bikes. She says they're concerned about riders sneaking up on bears and disturbing sage-grouse habitat. She says besides the social effect and possible conflict between other trail users, another issue at hand is the secretarial order broadly affects all field offices across the country.
And it is particularly concerning because this environmental assessment, it doesn't have any site-specific analysis about what impacts could look like on the ground for all of these different forms of recreation in this really sensitive area of Montana.
Last week, five national environmental groups filed a lawsuit to reverse a pro-e-bike policy in almost 25 different national parks, citing concern for parkgoers and park wildlife alike. Some e-bike proponents say that the electric bicycle is about the same as traditional bikes, just with an extra boost of power that can help people with physical limitations. Billings bike shop owner Dean Cromwell rides e-bikes himself and says e-bikes deserve a different classification than motor vehicles because they're still human-powered. He says he's seen a growth in the technological advancement and the popularity of e-bikes over the last few years.
I would say if I would give you the typical customer, it would be a husband and wife, because we usually sell them in pairs. A lot of them in the baby boomer age, because they're getting to the age where maybe they've had a hip replacement, they're a little older, they're not as strong as they used to be, they have a little discretionary income, they still want to be active, and these things really facilitate them to be able to do that.
BLM Montana Dakota State Office spokesperson Al Nash says the local office will take public comment into consideration and determine from there if additional analysis is needed about what type of activity is allowed in what area. He says the current plan does not go into detail about what type of recreational activity is allowed in different trails. It only distinguishes between motorized and non-motorized. The BLM has extended its Pryor Mountain Travel Management Area environmental assessment comment period by a month. The deadline for public comment is now January 6th. Kayla DeRoche, Yellowstone Public Radio News.
The U.S. Agriculture Department predicts American net farm income this year will be about 10% higher than in 2018. Great news, right? Not so fast, say some Montana farmers. Montana Public Radio's Edward O'Brien reports.
The newly minted president of the Montana Farmers Union summarizes the 2019 year in ag this way.
In one word, stressful. Family farm agriculture is in a crisis.
Walter Schweitzer raises registered Black Angus cattle and runs a hang operation near Geyser. He says lousy crop prices, growing operating costs, as well as mounting farm debt are heaping tremendous pressure on American family farms.
And yet they read the press and they watch TV and all they hear is how good things are and how great things are. And they think it's them. And they start to question whether or not they're just losers.
Schweitzer says it's taking a serious toll on farmers' mental health. According to Stateline, an initiative of the Pew Charitable Trusts, rural suicide rates are greater than urban ones, and the gap has grown steadily since 1999. Despite the immense pressures on family farmers, the federal government reports farm income in the country is going up. But this year, a significant chunk of that money came from the government. The USDA reports that direct government farm payouts increased by 64% in 2019. At the same time, farm receipts are expected to increase from animal products and crops 0.1% and 1% respectively. If the USDA's forecast pans out, this will be the third consecutive year of rising agricultural receipts. But Montana farmers aren't getting rich selling their product on the open market. The government is instead helping bail them out of the trade war doldrums. Many producers are just treading water. In ag lingo, the federal bailout for farmers is called the Market Facilitation Program.
To me, it makes no sense at all.
Again, MFU President Walter Schweitzer.
The intent behind it was to backfill the losses farmers were getting because of the trade wars. But when you look at where the dollars went, it wasn't going to the family farms, it was going to corporations.
According to the Washington, D.C.-based nonprofit Environmental Working Group, Montana farmers have received $115 million worth of federal bailout payments since 2018. Total market facilitation program payments in the United States over the past 2 years totaled over $14 billion, with the lion's share of that money going to Midwestern soybean producers.
We have the lowest rate of reimbursement of any states in the union. If you got it, it was less than 15 bucks an acre.
Vince Mattson is president of the Montana Grain Growers Association. Mattson's family operates a farm near Chester in north central Montana where they primarily grow winter wheat. Mattson says this year's drought in Liberty County was brutal on his crops.
And cut well below average yields, probably lowest in about 10 years or better.
Mattson says those federal ag bailout payments, combined with crop insurance, helped a lot of Montana farmers make it to the end of the year. But he adds no reputable ag producer would ever voluntarily choose subsidies over sales.
Just give us the ability to sell our product on a fair and equal playing field, and we'll take care of the rest. We would rather prefer that route than getting payment, for sure. No doubt about it.
Walter Schweitzer agrees.
We're here to feed the world, not to take a subsidy check. But, you know, they have no choice because their bankers are telling them, you need that. You need it any way you can get it because they got debt to pay.
Heading into the 2020 election, Schweitzer, who happens to be former Montana Democratic Governor Brian Schweitzer's brother, suspects some farmers are losing patience with the Trump administration's trade policies. Farmers and ranchers were a key Trump constituency in 2016. Montana Grain Growers Association Executive Vice President Lola Raska, however, says recent developments might just pay dividends for the Trump administration.
It's certainly been a roller coaster and very unpredictable all year, but now that we're seeing some results, I think there is a little bit more patience to see how these things turn out. I mean, we've got Japan in place now. That was critical for Montana, especially for Montana wheat producers. If we can get USMCA past the finish line, that would also be a positive sign.
Ultimately, rural loyalty to Trump will be decided next November. In the meantime, Montana Farmers Union President Walter Schweitzer advises farmers and ranchers to think about how to rebuild their overseas relationships damaged in the trade war.
You know, once you start buying from someone else, somewhere else, you start to develop a relation with someone else. And we're going to have to fight to get that back. So we're going to have to be funding trade missions and sending our family farmers to meet face-to-face with these customers of ours around the world and try to regain the trust that we once had so we can rebuild our markets.
Edward O'Brien, Montana Public Radio.
And that's what's happening in Montana today. Check in with Montana Public Radio's Montana Evening News for updates on the news of the day. For Yellowstone Public Radio News, I'm Jess Sheldahl. We'll have another episode of The Worm for you early birds Monday morning.
The Worm is produced by Jess Sheldahl for Yellowstone Public Radio. Theme music composed and recorded by Zach Jones at Rapscallion Recording. Meadowlark Call captured by Jay McGowan for the Macaulay Library. Partial funding for The Worm is provided by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montana. More information about The Worm is available at ypradio.org.